From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, Superhuman. Here's what's happening. Be careful if you get something in the mail from China. Over the past few weeks, people in Utah have been reporting mysterious packages that they've been receiving in the mail from China. Lori Cully said that she was excited to find two small packages in her mailbox. Although most of the writing on the outside was in Chinese, the label indicated that there would be earrings inside. She opened it up, and there were seeds. Now, she couldn't explain why she'd be receiving mislabeled seeds from China, but apparently it's happening all over the state. The Customs and Border Protection agents are investigating, and the Utah Department of Agriculture and Food will likely team up with them as well. Very strange story. And China today booted us out of one of their consulates in one of their cities in retaliation for what we did to them in Houston yesterday. 13 nuns at a Roman Catholic convent in Livonia, Michigan, have died of COVID-19 complications since the outbreak began there. 17 of the nuns have recovered. Wow. Bill Gates has warned that multiple doses of any coronavirus vaccine could be necessary as he slammed President Donald Trump's handling of the pandemic. The Microsoft billionaire Gates said serious mistakes have been made by the White House as he predicted schools could be closed until fall of 2021. Story we reported a couple days ago, for many people stuck in lockdown, social media is their best outlet for staying in contact with the world. And as the coronavirus pandemic continues to spread, fear of the illness remains high. Unfortunately, a new study finds that fear is turning into anger as the global community anxiously awaits for some kind of a cure. Dr. Peter Breggin, our resident psychiatrist, author of Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, with us. Peter, why are people getting angry? And they are. There's no doubt about that.
George, what's wrong with that? I mean, we're Americans. And not a lot of those people, I suppose, they were surveying are. They're from Singapore. But let's get angry. And why just be in fear? And the other thing they said is interesting is that joy is going up. So people are both grateful that it's not as bad as it was thought. People are grateful for the kindnesses they're seeing, and they're angry at the government. And that article says the governments of the world have to manage the people to keep them from getting angry. And, George, I think we should be angry.
Really? Yeah, but not violent, right?
Not violent at all, no. But angry and angry at the ballot box. And if you want to know who I think we should be angry at, go to my Coronavirus Resource Center. But that Ginger and I have put up, because we talk a lot about these issues. But, George, it's a good thing. I mean, they're scared. They're scared we're going to get angry.
So is being angry healthy, Peter?
Anger is healthy.
Huh.
You want to look deeper at what is the emotion you're feeling under the anger, because anger can be superficial. But we have real grievances going on here. We were told that millions of us were going to die just in America. We have been told this, we've been told that. And I think we should be saying, how do we want to live? We're Americans. How do we want to live from now on? So I'm in favor of our having feelings, George.
All right, Peter's website, Breggin, BREGGIN.com. He's got a lot of information there for you. Diets rich in protein are linked to a lower risk of death from any cause, with a particularly strong effect for plant proteins, including beans, lentils, nuts, according to research. Experts found that diets high in protein, particularly the plant protein, could lower the risk of early death, while swapping meat for plant protein may increase longevity. Rich sources of plant protein include beans, lentils, chickpeas, edamame beans, and nuts, and all kinds of things. So just remember that. Restricting television viewing to 2 hours a day could prevent or delay poor health, according to a new study. Health risks associated with screen time, such as cancer and cardiovascular disease, were at their lowest when daily television time was 2 hours or less. They said nothing about radio, by the way. Hurricane Douglas has rapidly intensified into a Category 3 hurricane with wind speeds now of 120 miles an hour. Yesterday, they were 75, and it's heading right toward Hilo, Hawaii. So let us keep our fingers crossed for those folks. Russia has secretly tested an anti-satellite weapon that they say could threaten the peaceful use of space. The Kremlin's military push to use weapons in space puts the U.S. and the allied space assets at serious risk, according to the U.S. Space Command. China has launched its first rover mission to Mars. The six-wheel robot, encapsulated in a protective probe, lifted off by Earth just a few hours ago. We'll monitor this story and see what happens. A story we have in the news at coasttocoastam.com from the New York Times, publishing a new article on the Pentagon UFO unit. It's a great story, and Lex went to Twitter to get your reaction. And if you're on Twitter, go and see some of the results there that have to do with great reporting from the New York Times. Nothing new here, folks, or incremental progress. Go take a look at the Twitter feed at coasttocoastam.com. UFOs always in the world here. Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hi, Peter. What do you have for us this week?
Good evening, George. My, what a week it's been. I'm not surprised the New York Times is publishing an article this week, because it's been an active week all around the world. I just shipped off about 330 new reports collected over the last week.
Ooh.
To my webmaster, and they should be posted to our website sometime tomorrow or even later tonight. Among those 330 are the following four, and wait until we get to the fourth one, George. It's a doozy.
Okay.
Tuesday morning of this week, the 21st of July, Baker, Oregon, a gentleman describes how he was driving on Interstate 84 just north of Boise, north of Baker, and he admits to having been driving at 85 miles an hour. He was coming up on a semi truck very quickly, and he looked in his rearview mirrors to clear traffic to pass a semi. And he was shocked to see two blue-green square objects oriented horizontally in his rearview mirror. He called his wife's attention to them. She looked back and said, "What in heaven's name is that?" He accelerated from his cruising 85 to go around the semi, and they just disappeared. They just suddenly put the brakes on and got very, very small in his rearview mirror. What they were, I have no idea, but very interesting story. Next one comes from Boise, Idaho, 11 p.m., just 50 hours ago. A gentleman who describes himself as a septuagenarian and ex-military, was in the Air Force for many years. He saw something that shocked him, George. I can still hear his alarm in his voice from the telephone conversation he and I had. He was looking to the north from his home in Boise and was shocked to see a orange sphere, perfectly spherical object, go streaking across the sky from northeast to northwest. And as he was watching it, trying to figure out what it was, he watched it for only about 15 seconds, he estimates. It suddenly, against a clear, cloudless sky, just disappeared from his sight. I'm going to skip the third one to go directly to the fourth one, which is the most interesting report I've received in a long time.
All right, love to hear it.
Reminiscent of the aerial school event that occurred in Zimbabwe back in 1994. Two young women were introduced to me by their school counselor over the telephone, and they told a story about how just yesterday morning, the 22nd, they were still awake at the home of one of them, and they saw a large craft. They estimate 50 feet in diameter, with a landing gear tucked up underneath it, with a red light around its flange and orange lights in the center of it. It's a most remarkable story. I won't be able to do it justice, but it should be posted to our website sometime tomorrow. So there's a lot going on, and we'll keep the Coast audience posted.
All right, Peter. Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. You know, we may have been one of the first to report when the COVID-19 broke in Wuhan. It wasn't called COVID-19 at the time. And it was a small little story that I noticed that had to do with a wet market that somebody somewhere in Wuhan had gotten very sick from eating a bat or a snake that might have been infected. And then later on, a few days later, we find out that there was a viral lab in Wuhan. I put two and two together, and I'm still convinced that this coronavirus was either created in that lab in Wuhan or delivered there, and they were trying to play with it, and something happened, and it got loose, and look at the mess that we are in now. In a moment, Dr. Ann Seifert joins us. We're going to be talking about epidemiology in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Dr. Ann Seifert with us. Ann is an epidemiologist, author, speaker, holds an MA degree in psychology from Smith College and a PhD in epidemiology from the University of California at Berkeley. Dr. Ann has focused on public health issues most of her career, conducting research at the Harvard School of Public Health and Nutrition and the Columbia University in Population Studies. Her work in epidemiology reached a turning point after she became a co-investigator after a National Institutes of Health study of more than 2,000 participants to understand how healthy people stay healthy. And for more than 30 years, she has focused on the prevention of chronic disease. Ann, I want to thank you for joining us tonight on what has been a very strange time over the last several months for everybody, but thank you.
I agree. It's been strange.
My, could anybody have predicted this?
Yes. That's the sad story here is that it was predicted. It's not that anyone could have it. It was. History tends to repeat itself. And if anyone is still living today, I don't know who experienced that 1918 Spanish flu, they will know it practically devastated the United States. And much of what we're seeing today is almost patterning in terms of public response, in terms of government response, what happened then? And that resulted in, no one knows exactly, but the guesses are 10 to 50 million deaths. So that was probably one of the most severe epidemics that this country will ever face, I hope.
We're going to get into COVID-19 with you, but how did you become an epidemiologist? Is this something you wake up and say, this is what I want to do?
No, it's not exactly something that as a child, you know, you're saying a fireman, a nurse, a teacher, a doctor, you don't usually come out with the word epidemiologist. And frankly, I'd never heard of it before I got to the School of Public Health at Berkeley. And I became fascinated by the subject because it's based on population studies. And so what you look for is basically what's happening to the people. That's the question you ask. If there's disease, then how is it spreading? It's a study of the distribution of disease and then how to intervene, how to control the spread. And there's a classic design in the epidemiological approach to the study of disease. And what I wanted to discuss today and bring to your attention and to the attention of everyone who's listening is what the epidemiologists do, and then also to discuss a little bit about what is a virus. Because I think with education, with understanding what that disease process is, people might be less angry about the demands that are being made upon us. Because I, like everyone else, am very distraught. Nobody likes having to change their lifestyle. And we've been asked to do that. But let me step back for a moment and just say that the epidemiologists, by and large, come out of the medical field. Most of them initially were coming from infectious disease studies, and they went into epidemiology. They go to a school of public health. They start out with an MD. They get a master's in public health in epidemiology, and then they go on sometimes to the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control, and that's kind of the mecca of epidemiology. This is where the brightest, the most interested, the top of the class, so to speak, this is where those people go. And I knew many of them when I was at Berkeley, and I can tell you that the men and women that I knew were very dedicated, educated, smart, and committed to public health. So these people, I feel, are good people. They're there to serve the public. They are trained traditionally, so you're not getting a lot of out-of-the-box thinking in terms of medical types of directives. But also there's a chronic disease section to epidemiology, and that's really where I was most concerned with, are the chronic diseases. Believe it or not, at the time that I was at the School of Public Health, we were all patting ourselves on the back saying, oh, we don't have to worry about infectious diseases anymore. Smallpox is under control. And then a whole bunch of new diseases came up. So I want to talk a little bit, unless you want to ask me another question.
Oh, yeah, I've got many for you, too, Ann, but you're on for a couple hours, so we've got a lot of ground to cover here.
Okay, well, let me talk about the disease process itself, because I feel with a greater understanding of what is a virus, that maybe more people will feel responsible.
All right. And what makes a virus different from another virus? We'll get into that, too.
Okay. Well, to start, a virus is actually not a living thing. I don't know if most people know that. It's actually not alive.
How could something that's not alive get to us this way?
Well, this is what I'm going to try to explain.
All right.
I think that once we understand this, it may change behavior. It may change some of that anger, because we're all feeling it. We're all feeling,
everybody's
why are we
tense.
Having to do this?
Yep.
So here we go. All right. So a virus is actually, if you can imagine it, it's just a little strand of information. It's like a code. It doesn't really have a life. According to virologists, it's a non-living entity. Now, some biologists will grant it that, well, maybe, you know, maybe it's a little biological, but here's what happens. This non-living entity is a parasite. It is the ultimate parasite. What this parasite does is to look for a host. And in the epidemiological model, the agent is the disease factor. It is the cause of the disease. The host is the human. So we are the host.
Well, let me stop you for a second.
Yes.
It must have some kind of intelligence to know to find a host. That's what's so mind-boggling to me.
Yes, it is. It is. I agree. And then the environment supports the agent, which is the virus, from finding this host. Now, the intelligence, apparently, it has feelers. It has a way when it enters into the human body of finding a living cell. And when it finds this living cell, it takes that cell hostage and thereby becomes a somewhat biological being. So it's almost like some of the things we see in science fiction, where there's a robot or something mechanical, it's not really alive, but then it can assume a biological identity.
How many of these little critters need to attack a human being before something happens?
I don't know how many. I know they get in and they replicate. So it's probably just one to start.
Just one little tiny thing. They're microscopic, aren't they?
Yes, they are.
Oh,
they are.
God.
And it depends on the host, which is the human, in terms of their immunity, in terms of their well-being, and how receptive they are, and what, you know, their general health, as to how rapidly these viruses will multiply. But the point I'm trying to get across here is that the only way that these viruses can, and I'll put in quotes, live, because they're not really living things, but they're using your cells to replicate, the only way they can go on and multiply is if they have cooperation from the host.
Now let's talk about that cooperation, Ann, when we come back. Dr. Ann Seifert with us. She's also an author. She's got a couple books out. We'll talk about that later on in the program. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Our special guest tonight is epidemiologist Dr. Ann Seifert. We're going to take calls with the doctor next hour. Lots more to talk with her about coronavirus and just viruses in general. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Ann Seifert with us. Ann, so you were saying the virus needs the cooperation of its host, but explain that for us.
Well, it needs a way to get into our body. And so how is it going to do that? It, generally speaking, it gets into our bodies from another human. And that's why I say that we are responsible, because the virus, especially COVID-19, is actually looking for, it works by droplet transmission. And so when it starts to replicate, which is its only job, by the way, that's the only thing this virus does. It gets into the body, it finds a living cell, it takes that cell as hostage, it uses that cell to duplicate itself. And then to continue replication, because eventually the host will either die or the host's immune system will kick in, it has to infect another host. So how does it do that? It does that because the sick host is putting forth droplets where another person comes by, another host, and they inhale it, or they touch something where those droplets are and put their hand to their face or in their mouth. So it's basically a moisture type of transmission.
What about the possibility? What about the possibility?
Cooperate for that virus to continue.
This is spread so fast, though, Annie.
Is that without our cooperation, we can stop the virus.
We've literally shut down the country, and it still hasn't stopped yet.
That's right, because people are not cooperating. This is what I'm saying. I went for a walk last night. I live near Seal Beach, and I went on the pier, and I was counting how many people were wearing masks and how many weren't and how many people were social distancing. And I'm sad to say that I my guesstimate was 50%. And so many people are confused. They don't know what to believe. They're upset, and they are angry. I heard your discussion with the psychiatrist, and may I say that one of the sad parts of this whole coronavirus is that I think people are actually going through what I call a grief cycle. The initial response is to deny that anything is really happening, that it's not real, that this couldn't be. And then when restrictions come into place, you get angry. Nobody likes being told that they have to not have big parties and they can't go out to the beach. And so many restrictions have come into play, and it's not pleasant. Nobody likes it. It's just not fun. And then usually after anger, and now we're starting to see this with some older patients that are confined. I'm hearing this from nurses. I'm not getting this from a study. I'm hearing this from nurses that people are getting depressed.
Yes.
And I heard from one nurse that suicide watch is now not uncommon among people who are isolated in nursing homes. They can't get visitors. And then the last part of a grief reaction, and I see this happening with President Trump, is acceptance. That at some point, people start to accept a new normal or a life that's different than what they had before. I am hoping that we don't ever have to go into a new normal, but I'm also hoping that people learn from this. And for keeping the virus at bay, keeping COVID-19 out of our bodies, the three recommendations that did come from the CDC, I want to talk a little bit about them because I want people to understand why those recommendations were made. The first recommendation was social distance I probably assume that everyone like myself didn't find that to be terribly effective. It's really hard to do. You go to the supermarket, you go any place. How are you going to stay 6 feet away? But nevertheless, it is the recommendation.
Well, and you don't know if it's 3 feet, 6 feet, 8 feet.
Recommendation, and then wearing a mask. So I'd like to discuss those three different recommendations, if I may. If you want me to stop at some point, let me know. Otherwise, I'll just keep going. But let's take the first one, the social distancing. Why? Why are we supposed to stay 6 feet away? Well, this is so that these droplets from an infected person don't get into our nasal passage and get to our lungs. I think that for that those droplets to travel that distance, someone really does need to have a pretty strong voice. I don't know if you've ever seen actors on a stage sometimes. In the old days, you used to see, you could actually see the spray coming from some of the actors' mouths. So it is possible that the spray from a person's mouth, just in conversation, could almost go that distance, but 6 feet's very safe. So that's why, because we're trying to keep the droplets away from your nasal passages. So that's that recommendation. Not that easy to completely follow. The recommendation of washing your hands is better, I feel, than that, because that really does basically kill that virus, even though it's not a living thing. I'm saying it kills it, because you can't kill something that's not alive, correct?
That's right.
So it inactivates it, let's put it that way. And why is that? Because what surrounds the COVID virus is sort of a lipid, and the soap actually destroys that little bit of a membrane, and that inactivates it. So washing your hands is very good, and it's good for everything. It's good for bacteria. I mean, that's something that I am hoping stays in place. There's no reason to ever stop doing that. If you go to a public place, if you put your hands on any surfaces where many people have gone by, the elevator buttons, things like that, it's just a good idea before you eat or before your hands get near your face, wash your hands. So that's why that's there. Now, the wear a mask, this is the most controversial one.
Sure is.
Surprisingly, it's also probably what we should have done day one, in my opinion. The Chinese had a lot of experience with SARS, and other countries have had a lot of experience with viral diseases where they really had to get them under control quickly, and that's what they did. They were very forceful. They were they really insisted that their residents wear masks, and in China and in Hong Kong, Taiwan, Japan, we have a different type of population. We have a population of people that are used to doing that. It wasn't a new thing. And so in this country, our country, we are resistant because it's as if someone is making us do something that we don't understand. So why are we doing that? Why are we doing that? Again, to stop the transmission of disease, to stop the droplets from going from person to person. And what I'm saying is that the only way that this coronavirus can infect people is one person to another. And so for all these cases that we're hearing about, someone gave that person the disease.
It went so fast, though. And let me ask you this, though. Let me stop you for a second.
They got it from somebody else.
What, aren't there some masks that are inferior to other masks? I see people wearing cheap-looking masks. I see people wearing elaborate masks. And I've been wondering, maybe that one doesn't work. Maybe that one does.
Well, here's my thought on this. And it's a matter of opinion, so I will give my opinion. First of all, the surgical mask, as we know, is something that we don't want people going out and buying because we still have a low inventory. But that one's the most effective, and that's 90 to 97%. 100% cotton mask, which is like a T-shirt or anything else that you can, some cotton sheets might do if they're double folded, that would be very good. We're talking about maybe 69% effective. And if you've got a 4-ply microfiber type of towel, which you can get probably in hardware stores and elsewhere, we're talking between 75 to 83% effective. So in my opinion, and I wear a mask. I have different masks for different occasions, actually. I have a bandana that I wear for walking. Why? Because I know that outdoors, it's much less likely that any droplet will get to me, and I keep the 6 feet. So if you do those two things, you have lowered your risk tremendously, and I find the bandana very comfortable for walking. I use another mask if I go to a hospital or healthcare center. I always wear my surgical mask. I have one, but it's not the N95. It's a typical surgical mask that you can get in many places.
Well, Ann, let me ask you this real quick. This started with one person in Wuhan, China, getting infected. And look what's happened across the planet. Now, if we all wore masks and it all went away, what about that one person on the planet who still might have it? Is this going to start all over again?
It could if we let our guard down. And this is the interesting part about epidemics, is that if you don't control it at the outset, it spreads. I mean, this is a highly contagious disease. COVID-19 has an infection rate of over 2. It's 2.2, actually. So that means that each infected person will spread it to at least 2 other people. And so it has to be stopped. It just has to be stopped. And the earlier you start, the greater the chance that you will nip it in the bud, and it will flatten out, as Dr. Fauci has been so famous for saying. And then we hope that the new susceptibles will not be infected, or at least won't be as much. And then if they start to get infected again, we have to go back to some conservative measures. The problem we're really having here is that we don't have a good way of containing or controlling COVID-19. It's a new virus. It, compared to the flu, this virus is something we just don't know enough about. We know a little bit more, I should say much more, about the flu. We have a vaccine for it. We can, contain it. Most people are, if they're relatively healthy, will get through it. They won't die. What's happening with COVID-19, this is my evaluation, is that we're seeing that as the high-risk groups that we started out with are starting to change a little bit. And I'm thinking to myself, well, why is that happening? I think what's happening is that our host population is starting to get immune or is starting to have already had the disease, or some antibodies have been produced. So the virus needs new people. They're going now for the 20 to 30 years olds in New York now are the largest number of new cases. And we don't really know exactly how this COVID-19 gets around which are the people that are highest risk. Is that going to change? What about children? Are their symptoms different? So there's just a lot to learn that we really don't quite have a handle on it yet.
Some are beginning to think, Ann, as I do, that it could be airborne, not just 6 feet droplets. What do you think?
Well, I think it is, especially in a closed space. This is one of the problems, and this is something that I wish the CDC would do. If you ask me where can we do better, it's at this type of control. What we're finding is that people in enclosed spaces, restaurants, bars, where there's air conditioning, where the circulation is basically, you know, the same air is going around and around. And there is an index case. There was a case in China, a woman in a restaurant, an enclosed space. She infected 9 other people in that restaurant. She didn't know that she had the virus. She was asymptomatic. The next day she got a fever. And then after that, those 9 people who were in that restaurant came down with it as well. And they traced it back to the fact that this was in an enclosed space with air that was circulating, completely no fresh air coming in. So it makes a difference whether or not you are in an enclosed space or not.
And we're going to take a quick break. Hold on. We're going to take a break and come back and talk more about COVID-19. We'll also take some phone calls from our listeners who are very concerned about the spread of this disease. And we'll talk more about what do we do? I mean, do we literally shut down the economy? And then for how long? How long do you have to do that? Those are just a few more questions when we come right back.